This is Artist Stories, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. I'm your host, Ava Romero. Today, I'm with Spencer Edgerton, a sculptor and maker. Welcome, Spencer.
Hi, happy to be here.
Talk to us about your brainchild, WeRobot.
WeRobot. It is a big machine that makes art for people. So a specific kind of art, it makes spherical illuminated sculptures. And the way it works is people submit an idea in the form of a drawing or a vector graphic image. And our robot uses plasma cutters and motors and gizmos to carve that design into a big steel sphere, like a 400-pound ball of iron. And then that, as part of the WeRobot experience, that sculpture is then sited here in Tucson publicly and illuminated at night to make shadow art or just like a cool place-holding sculptural phenomenon. And the public is invited to submit ideas. So if you hear my voice right now and you have an idea, get in touch.
Tell us a little bit about where the root of WeRobot came from.
In a way, two ideas kind of came together to make WeRobot. The simpler idea is Bruce Shapiro's Eggbot. The Eggbot is an invention by artist Bruce Shapiro to prove to the world he wasn't crazy, because he was playing with computers and motors and making the motors do little weird things, and it didn't seem to be going anywhere. So he made, I guess for his kids or something, this device that painted on Easter eggs, essentially. Like, you can do designs on eggs. I saw that and thought, well, I could make a big one of those. Like, that doesn't have to be small and on eggs. Like, this idea has a lot of potential. So I got in touch with him and got his permission to develop that idea into the WeRobot. The root is, I was already making steel chimeneas out of old propane tanks and buoys. These buoys from World War II, actually. They were like drift net buoys. Anyway, the big steel balls, and I would use a plasma cutter and by hand carve designs into the balls. And that really took off. In 2016, I got a grant from Burning Man to make like a planetary system out of those balls and then have them be fireplaces at night. So it was like a whole system with each planet sort of with a different design to reference the history of astronomy, astrology, and human planetary interaction. And it also turned into a warm place to hang out in the cold desert nights. WeRobot proper is a way of sharing that art making enjoyment that I got when I was producing those sculptures by hand with the public, who may not have the tools or technology to make those sorts of things themselves. My robot can now make those ideas based on their drawing. So it kind of does the hard part of making that kind of sculpture.
Being that this is a interactive, democratizing, kind of equalizing art experience that allows everybody ideally to be able to make something that would maybe otherwise be outside of their reach. What's your invitation to the public?
If you want to be a part of it, please check out the website, we.ei-robot.com. We'll tell you everything you need to know about making a drawing that will work with our machine.
And you are accepting calls.
Yeah, we're still open. If you look at the website, it has a December 15th deadline that is no longer accurate. That was the first round, and we selected a design, but we are going to be making 5 of these in Tucson. So if you're in Tucson or Southern Arizona, please submit a design, get your friends to submit designs. We need art, and it'll be a blast when you see it, you know, glowing in all its glory here in town. And I think getting people involved with public art is awesome.
So is there going to be an event where people can go and watch this machine create the art that they ideated?
Yes. The machine was originally made to be a performance piece at the Burning Man event. So it is full of lights and sounds, and it actually does the carving, the plasma cutting, in a public and spectacular way. It lifts the ball like 15 feet into the air and then starts plasma cutting because that's more awesome. And yeah, we're having an event here in Tucson, and it should be a lot of fun. The first art that we selected, we're going to carve in a sort of a party for the public at the Launchpad Studios, and we haven't picked a date yet, but tune into the website and or the Artist Stories website, and we'll let you know. It'll be this spring, 2020.
That will be fun. Our society is rather success-obsessed. people are often afraid to fail and therefore afraid to embark on their artistic visions. Could you tell us about the failures and successes of the project?
One of the things I'd like to talk about is just being brave enough to try things. Like, trying new things always is fraught with potential disaster. And just as I would like to encourage people to submit designs to this project, I at different times had to submit my idea to foundations and to get this project off the ground. Burning Man has a grant proposal system, and so does Arts Foundation. As an artist, I mean, I am a professional artist in more than one way. I often have to submit ideas before I know how to make the idea happen. I have to tell someone that I do. So that how do I do that with a reasonable expectation that it will come to fruition is that's tough. What is important for me in that process is talking to smart people who I think are smarter than me in certain areas, or are more experienced than me, and getting their feedback. I did that with the We Robot project, and that's kind of how I know it works and it's fine. But that can backfire. When we got to Burning Man in 2018, that had a very short timeline for building it. It was kind of fun, but fun like surviving an airplane crash or something like that. Like, the timeline was so short and the budget was so tight that it was kind of amazing that we pulled it off at all. We tested all the different subsystems of the robot before we left, but we were never able to assemble the whole thing. And when we got to Burning Man, like, we turned it on and it didn't work. Like, on a CNC robot, there's something called a Z-axis, and our Z-axis had sensors on it that sent feedback to a microcontroller, and it basically, as part of its startup cycle, it sent an error message, and we didn't find that while we were up there. And then it basically shut itself down. It went to like an emergency fault state, and like, we couldn't get it to work. Some of our people were not at Burning Man, and we couldn't call them from Burning Man, so we were basically dead in the water, and it was terrible. Doing Weave Robot in Tucson is sort of an outgrowth of that experience, because here we have access to resources and we can call friends to help, and we can test it out at our own pace and much better conditions than moving something, a big piece of complicated machinery, into the middle of nowhere and hoping that'll work without having tested it. Yeah, that was insane. The insanity of it, though, like, I wasn't joking when I said it was kind of fun. Like, the enormous energy of the people involved and the can-do attitude and the willingness to come together and work on a big project was something that made a difference to me. It made a difference to a lot of people. It was inspirational, and I'm really glad I did it. I guess if you're an artist and you have fear of failure is a big factor in like blocking you or preventing you from going forward with your art, take those chances. They go places. There's really no other way to do it than stepping into the abyss and finding out what happens next.
For people who have never been to Burning Man, could you describe that experience?
Nope. It's like going to another planet, really. I mean, like, it has a lot of similarities to Earth in that there's gravity, there's people. Like Burning Man is different than most events. Like, say, if you go to a concert, you go to Coachella, you go to South by Southwest. Those events are, you pay for a product, kind of, you get to see music and experience a crowd, that's the exchange. It's transactional. And Burning Man's not like that. It's like going to a city and then just meeting the people who live in the city, and you're one of them. And so you're a part of it. And so I think what people get out of that is they're not spectators. They're part of the show. So it's very difficult to describe because it's different every time. And it depends on the people you meet and what you bring to it. As an artist, for me, Burning Man is it's like a gallery. It's a canvas. It is a museum. It's brilliant from the perspective of a person who studied a lot of art history and makes art professionally. It's really the best gallery on the planet right now. There's Art Basel Miami, but that's like much more constrained. And I my day job is working at a bronze casting foundry. I work at Metalphysic, and bronze casting is a very conservative art form because it's there's a lot on the line. It's expensive, and there's like huge timelines to make things, and it's usually viewed in a very strict, rigorous context, like in a gallery or a park or something like that. Burning Man is completely different. I mean, still sculpture. It's still like, I'm more engaged with the sculpture. There's other art forms there, but it's free to be radical, partially because of the lower cost for some of the art. But I mean, there's still millions being spent there on some of the art too. So that's not it exactly. The way people interact with it, people's expectations of what the art is, and I would say the short timelines change people's relationship. And so you can, as an artist, your voice can be really radical there. Like you can say things with sculpture that you can't say other places. Like, for instance, there's art, a lot of art there moves. There's a lot of mechanical things. And that's really hard to do in a public setting other places, because you need a whole team of people to set it up and watch it and manage it. And you can only do that for a very limited time. But there it is a limited time. It's just a week. Also, there's an element of danger there that's fine. Like our Wii robot, I should say, it makes sparks and moves heavy objects in a way that's like terrifying, you know? And at Burning Man, that's fine. And at the launch pad where I'll be hosting the event, that's fine. But I couldn't just put that in a public park, not without, some barrier or something to keep everyone safe. But that is one of the great things about Burning Man. I think a lot of people know that things are on fire there often, and they've made a very safe way to have that kind of experience, but there's still people periodically do get hurt. And it's sort of, I guess, what you accept when you go.
You had mentioned bringing people onto this large-scale project and how it was really meaningful for the team.
Yeah, that is, I think, one of the most important parts of the whole thing. So the name of the robot was originally iRobot, and that had to do with the Asimov book, The Laws of Robotics. And it was spelled E-I instead of with letter I, and that's because of its roots with the eggbot, because that's the German word for egg is I. I don't know, das I. We started calling it We Robot because it seemed like the best thing about it was how it brought people together and inspired people, including the team of volunteers that helped build it. My friend Ethan Wilson has gone on. He's now building his own large-scale interactive art pieces. Like Opus Palace is one. Amanda Smith, who is, I should mention, is partnering with me on the We Robot project and helping me administer it and make decisions with it. She's started a business called Golden Productions. It is an art management service. Liz Cameron was very inspired by the whole process, and she's gone on to start a school for blacksmithing, and she learned to weld. I think she had some basic knowledge of it, but she learned to weld during that project, now teaches welding. And it's, I could go on. So many of the people that were involved in that project were inspired by the passion and energy and seeing like what you can do if you put your mind to it. And they've gone on to start all sorts of businesses and become artists themselves. That was really great. And that's why we call it the We Robot, and our sort of our catchphrase is be a part of it, because that's what makes it great. I'm an artist. I can hang out in my studio and make stuff. That's like not hard for me. It's fine. But sharing the experience is just more powerful. One of the things we started talking about during the process is how collaboration is amplification. It makes things better. It just, the power and the energy and the passion just get multiplied when you successfully find a way to work with other people who want to give it their best. It's awesome.
So speaking of iRobot as a huge scale project that involved a lot of people, a lot of resources, and just actual size, it's large. Could you tell us about predecessor projects?
So you've been to the studio and you've seen the big bot, the Wii robot. It's built on a high boy shipping container basis. So that's like 9.5 feet tall. And then it has this big arm that like lifts up the balls. The balls are like 400 pounds and they're like 4 feet across. And it's pretty, like the scale of it is impressive. Just like, how does someone make something like that? Like the answer there is, we did a bunch of, work in software and sketchbooks and, materials. I'm not going to say material science, but engineering to figure out how to do it. That is, I think, the biggest and most complicated thing I have made to date. And I've made some stuff since then that is also like big enough that you can go inside of it. You know, these buildings I'm making now, the heart chakra temples, but pr- prior to that, I think the biggest thing I made was the Chiminea Planetaria sculpture group, which now you can see about half of it at the JCC as part of their permanent collection, and then the other half is in a private collection. I learned a lot from that. That was the first project I made that I couldn't pick up or move in my car. You know, I needed like a extra truck and trailer to move it around, and I actually built a electric hoist on my truck so I can pick them up. And it was kind of a cool project because I took it to all these different festivals and got really good at loading and unloading the planets. That was a lot of fun. I guess that was a big step from between sculpture of the scale that I could pick it up and move it with my own two hands to where I needed machinery to move things around. Those planets, there was a way I could roll them and move them around on site by myself. One person could do that, but then I couldn't pick one up. For that, I needed the crane. So that was kind of in between. And the Wii robot, it needs a forklift. It has wheels, and four people can push it around on a flat concrete surface. But we put it on a truck. we need a forklift for that. Not just any forklift, had to be a pretty good one. I hope I do more work of that scale because it's awesome. People engage with it in a different way. Like, big sculptures are sort of different than little sculptures. They're much more difficult actually for the artist. Like, every sort of order of magnitude bigger in scale, like there's an order of magnitude more work that you have to do to make it happen. It's tempting sometimes to work in a way that's comfortable, like something you can finish before bedtime. You know, that has to be about the size of a basketball or smaller, you know. To work with bigger projects like that, you need large timelines, big spaces, and money to make it all happen. And every problem is like a little amplified, you know. But worth it, because it makes such a big impact on people.
Tell us about your history with public art.
I have an art degree from the University of Arizona, and before I finished my degree, I worked with an artist named Bob Wick in his studio making large-scale monuments. I had done some art in Tucson, like large-scale art for like private commissions. My first public art piece was the part of the Luminarias del Pueblo project. And I actually worked with KXCI to make a sculpture called Luminous Crystals, which was a solar-powered glowing crystal formation. During the gem show, we showed it over at the TCC. It was kind of great because, like, it was these big glowing red crystals. It sold at an auction to help raise money for KXCI. And they only did the Luminarias del Pueblo project 1 year, but I met a bunch of people. Some artists who I then later worked with at the Metalphysic Foundry, Ed Murin and Joseph Lupiani. They were part of that, and so was Joe O'Connell, who now has Creative Machines. I think that was probably his first public art project. So I feel like that Luminaria del Pueblo was actually really successful at bringing artists together and helping artists on their path. But for me, it was a pivotal project, and I was really happy to be a part of it.
So could you describe the piece by the Tucson Museum of Art?
Oh, the big desert O, the Glownut. I love that name. So that is a plexiglass toroid, like a sandblasted plexiglass toroid made out of multiple smaller pieces. Joe should be able to tell his own story, but I think he made the individual pieces in his oven, like at home or something. And then it has like LEDs inside. And I think, is it touch sensitive? Some of his pieces are. I don't remember if that one is. But it might be.
It's kind of fun to go by these iconic pieces of public art and actually know something about them, because often nobody knows anything about them. They feel like they've just sprang out of the ground one night, but that's not how public art happens.
No. So yeah, that project Luminarias del Pueblo, the challenge was artists would each pair with a charitable organization and produce together. They'd produce a piece of art that was solar powered and would light up at night. And that's the idea where the Luminaria, which is a I think a Southwestern sort of an iconic feature of Southwestern community, is. Each artist had a different take on that. Mine was the crystals. Joe's was the glow nut. And like there was just a, I thought it was a great outpouring of ideas. The auction was really fantastic. It was over at Star Pass, and there was all these big, beautiful sculptures there that were later situated around town. I'd have to say that the Wee Robot Project also has something in common with that, in that it will make glowing works of art and we'll put them around Tucson. So it's the same in that way. Maybe that's where I got the idea. I don't know. Joe did an interesting thing at that auction. He bid on his own piece, and I think he bought it and then later donated it to the museum, which was just like, it showed, I feel, a lot of character and a lot of belief in his own work.
Embarking on iRobot actually involved a transition for you, because you had a hard time with Dragonspine.
Yeah, so Dragonspine was the first work of art. It was a private commission that I did after getting my Bachelor of Fine Arts degree. There's some ins and outs there, so I'll just, I guess, try to tell the story as best I can. So I was hired to do the piece, and I was given what I thought was a pretty great budget. I think it was about $5,000. And the piece, as we designed it, is it's on Ponotok, so anybody who hears this can go take a look at it. It's a big red series of these metal kind of delta shapes that almost look like birds flying off into the sky, and they called it Dragon Spine because to me it looked almost like vertebrae of some like big monster or something. Anyway, it started, I did some smaller versions of that, and the person who commissioned me liked it, and so we went for it. I started making it at my house at the time in Tucson. My father got sick during that time with some heart issues, and I had to go. I'm from Bisbee, and I moved back to Bisbee to take care of him. And I didn't have a studio in Bisbee to work at. A friend who lived outside of town let me use their space, so I like out in the desert, and so I would commute out there and work on it. It was very inconvenient moving it. Like, I couldn't move it myself. This is, I think, it speaks to your earlier question about like scale. It was a terrible pain trying to move this. Like I needed friends with trailers, and I had to move it several times while it was being made, and I eventually finished it in a friend's backyard here in Tucson, and then had it powder coated and installed it. And it was all kind of way beyond my capacity to work. Unlike the iRobot or Wee Robot project, I didn't have a great space to work in or a crew of people to help me. It was just me trying to make it work and not knowing what I was doing. And it was kind of traumatic. And like, I think that did, that prevented me from taking on big projects like that for a long time. And I just, it sort of threw a big wrench into where I thought my career was going, because I realized that this was a lot harder than I had imagined. Like, getting a big sculpture off the ground is a monumental task. Maybe that's why they use that word, monumental.
Art is not always just fun and games, right? I mean, there's often a part of the process that's very painful, even in the best of times, right?
Yeah, well, sculpture is maybe really special with that. Like, if I was a poet, maybe I'd have a different story. But I have scars on my legs still, where I cut myself with a grinder making that Dragon Spine project. Because they think of it like a metal artist. Oh, you're a welder. It's like, yeah, of course we weld, and welding is fun, and it's one of the more pivotal skills. But using a grinder, it's this rotating wheel of abrasive. You do that probably as much or more than you weld when you do these kinds of like big steel projects. They'll take a bite out of you. They shoot sparks everywhere, these hot sparks, and they're dirty.
People often talk about grant processes as onerous, meaningless hoop jumping. But I really liked how you have some things to say about going through the Burning Man art grant process that were useful.
They've made their process, I think, help the artist as they go through the process. There are things I'm critical about. Like, I don't like their timelines. Like, the way it worked for me is I got half of a year to think about the project and 3 months to make it, you know. And it ended up being a huge problem for that project. It worked fine with the Chimenea Planetaria, so maybe that's the scale that works with that process. But I think, to answer your question, the way they start their process is with a letter of intent, where you just kind of pitch your idea. I'm sure there's a panel that looks these over and picks out their favorites. And that's great for everybody, because you can come up with a wild idea that may or may not make sense, and they get to kind of think, well, maybe it makes sense. The next step is where it really, I think, it helped me figure things out, and they also get to see where you're coming from. They ask in the second, like the full proposal is the next step. And Arts Foundation does something similar. So I'm not going to knock their process. It is actually similar in a lot of ways. But that second step, they ask all these questions about structure and safety, and they want like architectural drawings, and they really want you to flesh out the idea, and they still might say no. So it's sort of at that point up to the artist to present their idea like with a roadmap to getting it done. They work with you to make a landmark of achieving progress with your idea. And for me, with the iRobot project, that was making a little working model of it, similar to the Eggbot machine.
And that's so important, having those milestones in the process, because it allows you to divide up your project into these manageable steps, and it helps you to stay on track for fruition.
Yeah, so that's true. In the case of the iRobot project, in hindsight, they also disperse money in chunks depending on their timeline and your progress, and that didn't work out because we had to buy so much like heavy equipment up front that where we couldn't really build it until the last minute. We essentially made that giant monster of a robot in like 6 weeks. Like I said, that was a fun 6 weeks, but it was also very stressful. I was still working at my day job during that time, so it was crazy. At one point, I counted up just the hours, and it was like for the amount of what we got done, it was insane. And the crew was so great; they were coming over at night and mornings and weekends, and it was pretty spectacular.
Your life and art trajectory follow an interesting geography, Spencer. Could you tell us about growing up in Bisbee and Germany?
From Bisbee, I lived there from 1974 to 1985. And then my dad, who'd worked at Fort Huachuca before that, he got a job in Germany, that time West Germany. It's a country that no longer exists. But like as part of the NATO alliance against the Red Menace, the communists in Russia, right? So I was a big deal back in the 80s. So for me, moving to Germany when I was 15, Bisbee was, it had a strange quality to it, because Bisbee, if you've ever been there, you drive through a tunnel to get there. It's very isolated. It's up in the mountains. And then there was no internet, and it was hard to get radio. We had a local radio station, but it wouldn't go through the mountains, so we couldn't get a lot of outside information. The mines had shut down at that point, and so things like the public library wasn't getting new books. There was no bookstore in town, so all the reading material was from the 50s and 60s, and so in a lot of ways it was like growing up in the 50s or 60s in this isolated part of America that wasn't connected to the rest of the world. Very strange. I mean, I imagine maybe the Appalachian Mountains or Alaska, there might be similar areas of America that are that isolated, but even for Arizona it was isolated because it was, you know, 100 miles from Tucson, and Tucson was 100 miles from Phoenix, and like no one drives to Bisbee except to get to Bisbee because it's not on the way to anywhere else. So super isolated. When I moved to Germany, it was in the middle of a city. Nuremberg is, I think, bigger than Tucson and is certainly much more connected. Like I think when we spoke earlier, I gave the example of like I could see an American rock band play at a concert down the street from where I lived in Germany, and in Bisbee, that was, I didn't even know who those bands were, because like how would I, you know? So in a way, for me, moving to Germany was almost like moving to America from this other place. I mean, Bisbee was so strange, and it was almost a very remote outpost. And so moving to Germany, it was kind of when I actually became aware of American normal society of the 80s. How that affected me artistically. Like in Bisbee, like my mom was a goldsmith, a silversmith and goldsmith, and that's a big kind of cottage industry down there. Turquoise and malachite, azurite. That was definitely a big difference, and it became her career once she got started. But her jewelry shop was my bedroom. Like it was the same, because we only had so many rooms in the house, and so I grew up around metalworking and like casting and making things. And my mom was a huge influence on me, actually. Like her attitude of like, oh, we'll just make it. Like she can make anything. And she's a very super charismatic artist, a little bit locally famous in Bisbee. And I still see like her sculptures now, like at people's houses and stuff. It's like her art, I think, went well with that town. But then that was like my only experience with art before I moved to Germany when I was a teenager. And then I lived down the street from the German National Museum, and there was all these Gothic cathedrals in that town. Nuremberg is kind of part of the Northern Renaissance. Albrecht Dürer lived there. And there was so much visual art available to me. And in some of it directly, I think, influential to what I'm doing now, like astrolabes. There was this medieval astronomy happening there, where they made these great devices, astrolabes and compasses, and the earliest pocket watch, I think, was made there. So there was this great connection to like mechanical, astronomical, and time-related art that is influential to what I do now and what interests me now.
But you weren't always committed to being the kind of maker artist that you are today.
No, that's funny. In high school, I had some really good English teachers. One in Bisbee, Bill Sullivan, and then another teacher, Bill Mulder, and Mrs. East. I still don't know her first name, but like these great English teachers. And I read a lot. I was a very voracious reader, like Kurt Vonnegut and like Tom Robbins and Salinger and Steinbeck and like all these great like authors. I originally thought I would be a writer, like coming out of high school. That was my interest and focus. Even though I did have these roots in visual art, I didn't see myself as being a visual artist until later.
How'd you get there?
That's a great question. So I made money with metalwork before. I mean, I've never published anything that I've made money with. So I think that was it. Like I knew I could make a living doing it. I started making jewelry, and then I worked at a copper smithing place in Bisbee, the Romance Copper, and I had this kind of a strange job, like in their tool room, using this old machine called a spinning lathe, which is this, it's hugely dangerous. Basically you deform this spinning metal saw blade using metal bars and rollers. And like, it's this antique process that was big in the 1800s and early 20th century, and they don't really do it anymore, but that was part of my job there. And so I got good, I think, grounding in craftsmanship, like metal craft, before I considered using those skills in the service of art making, which I think kind of came later. At one point, I remember touring the University of Arizona. This was in my early, mid-20s maybe. I saw them casting bronze, and I thought, that's what I want to do. So bronze casting as a craft, I'd cast copper before then and silver, but that craft got me interested in sculpture in a way that had maybe been in the back of my mind, but not, I didn't think of it as a career path until I saw people doing that at the U of A, I guess. So bronze casting is kind of a special art form for me, and I really love it. But metal fabrication, like with steel and other sculptural forms of, I guess I've branched out to do those things as well.
I was just going to ask you if you wanted to add anything.
We picked our first design for the WeRobot project. It was submitted by Sharon Holmbach of Triangle L Ranch in the GLOW event. But she submitted a design of these sort of flowers or trees that I think are just going to look great on one of the spheres. Like I think the machine will be able to carve it up pretty well. And that's the first one we want to do.
Thank you for speaking with us today, Spencer.
Oh, thank you. It was great being here. And I love KXCI and always happy to visit the studio.
This has been Artist Stories with Ava Romero, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. To listen to more podcasts, visit kxci.org. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County.